All right, this is May 22nd, 2008, and we're with Russ Overby, who's an attorney with Legal Aid Society. We could start out and tell me again how you came to Legal Aid and when and what brought you here.
Sure. I had gone to law school with the idea that I wanted to do public interest law. Mm-hmm. And so when I came to Vanderbilt in 71, I immediately started calling the program to see whether they would let me work there. And in 1972, which was my second year of law school, I was hired as a law clerk. And at the time, the senior attorney was Dave Tarpley, who had graduated in 1971. So everyone was very new, but it was a very exciting time, too.
Now, from what I understand, the idea of legal services was kind of strange to the private bar. And what I've heard so far is that there was a lot of kind of trepidation about when can you just, was that still in the case when you were there? Or?
Yeah, I was not there at the beginning when it's at least my understanding that the State Bar Association was opposed to the formation of legal services, but some of the attorneys who were interested talked about perhaps approaching a labor union about establishing legal services, and at that point they did that. That was before my time, but I think when there's been a huge change, I think, in the bar's response to legal services since I started as a lawyer in 74. Even in 74, there were a lot of lawyers that were supportive, including lawyers who were on the other side of our cases. I think initially there was a concern that we might take away business from lawyers in private practice. However, most of our clients are so desperately poor that they could not possibly afford to hire a private attorney. And there was, I think there was more tension, I think, between the state government and us than there is now. Part of that was there were, it was really a different time. It was a time when just because the Supreme Court said you couldn't do something didn't necessarily mean that our state government or our local judges, for example, would follow that. So there was a lot of litigation just simply enforcing recent Supreme Court decisions. There was a commissioner of the Department of then Public Welfare, Fred Friend, and the Tennessean would literally publish a scorecard, Legal Services of Nashville 3, Fred Friend 0, because there was so much litigation going on, and much of it was just enforcing Supreme Court decisions. So I think there was more skepticism on the part of the bar as to who are these people. But we were really lucky to have a couple of directors, first Walt Kurtz and then Ashley Wiltshire, that I think did a tremendous job of improving our stature before the bar. When Walt was only director for 2 years, but I remember when he left in 76 to become the public defender in Knoxville, the attorney general's office had a luncheon for him. And at that point, we were in court on the other side from the attorney general's office on a weekly basis. And at any one time, we'd have two and three class actions going. And it was their respect for his integrity and our ability. And so, you know, by the late 70s, I think there had been a significant change in the perception of the private bar with respect to legal services.
Okay. Now, What were those early cases like? I mean, you obviously had a lot more freedom to take whatever came through the door then. What were you getting a lot of them?
Well, when I first started, we took anything and everything from a name change to litigation around the conditions at Clover Bottom Developmental Center, which was the institutional placement for mentally retarded persons, to conditions litigation about the prison. The juvenile detention center system, the metro jail. So there was conditions litigation with respect to all of that. Another thing that we got involved in was representing children at Spencer Youth Center, which was a juvenile facility for delinquents and unruly's, and the Supreme Court had held several years earlier that, like adults, juveniles had a right to counsel in cases where their liberty was at stake. And some of the juvenile judges were not very impressed by what the Supreme Court had to say. So for a period of 3 or 4 years, we were bringing a regular stream of what's called habeas corpus actions. And the hearing was about, was this juvenile ever afforded a right to counsel? And because the juveniles were here in Davidson County, we were calling into question the practices of juvenile courts across the state. Mm-hmm. We had one class action case that we brought on behalf of parents whose children were removed by what was then the Department of Human Services because they were allegedly neglected and dependent. And the problem was that there would be this order by the judge without a hearing or anything, and the children would be removed, and in some cases it could be 2 or 3 months before there was a hearing. And at least in some of those cases, the children were returned at that time because it was determined the threat wasn't that great. But in the meantime, this had occurred. And at the same time, you know, this was the 70s, and there was a lot of research and kind of foment around things like that. Some doctors at Yale wrote a book called Beyond the Best Interests of the Child that talked about, for particularly young children, how quickly the bonds can be severed between a parent and a child. And the focus was, you need to do this quickly. B, you need to be very careful about taking children away from parents. And C, if the parents really are not fit, you need to get them into a stable, permanent placement as soon as possible. And one of the authors of that actually gave us a deposition in the case we brought against the juvenile court judges all across the state, because they were not they weren't determining whether there was any irreparable harm before they were removing the children. And they were not holding any types of preliminary hearings. And one juvenile judge in East Tennessee was so unimpressed with the lawsuit that he issued an injunction against us, the judge in the case, and the state in proceeding with the case. And the state attorney general's office, representing themselves and the judge, and an attorney in private practice representing us, went to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court told that judge, this is not your jurisdiction. You're enjoined from entering any more orders enjoining the proceedings. And eventually we entered into an agreed order that said that children couldn't be removed unless the court had made a finding that there would be irreparable harm. And this could be based on hearsay at this point. It could be based on the workers, because there was a recognition that in some cases this needs to happen. And then there had to be a preliminary hearing with less stringent rules with respect to evidence within 72 hours. And that's now part of our state law, but that's how that happened. So there was a lot around the nexus between state agencies acting as custodians of people and court procedures during the 70s.
Okay. Now, you said you were at the Sudicum building.
Right.
So you've been through several buildings.
Yeah, we had an elevator operator at the Sudicum building, and the Cokes were a nickel in the machine in the basement.
Okay, so now help me out. Did the Sudicum come before or after Parkway Towers?
That was before Parkway Towers. They started out in the Stallman building, and that was before I began as a law clerk in 1972. Mm-hmm. And then they moved to the Sudicum building, which was on the corner of 6th and Church and is now a condo, I think, but it's not the same building. And we moved to Parkway Towers in 1977, mm-hmm. and we were there until 1985.
I see. And then you went back to the Stallman.
Back to the Stallman building.
Okay. All right. Now, let's see. Let's talk a little bit about the organization itself. What do you see as the milestone events or the watershed events over the course of
I think really of two things. On the individual cases, I think they had an impact on the whole legal community. Mm-hmm. One example that I'm familiar with is I do housing cases.
Sure.
And because of the work, particularly of Drake Holiday, who did that work for over 20 years before I did, people get notices that explain why the housing authority wants to put them out, so they have some idea as to what they're up against. They have an administrative hearing process where they have a chance to tell their story. The judges, the General Sessions judges, have been educated not just in this area, but, for example, in consumer, where Dave Tarpley has had a mega effect on the practice of consumer law on behalf of debtors. They've been educated about what those laws, and they will now on their own raise those, because it's now been, 40 years really of advocating for people, making the courts aware of those laws. So the individual cases, I think, have made the whole legal community much more aware of what are the laws that protect low-income people. The class actions have changed the face of what opportunities low-income people have in the state around health care. There are hundreds of thousands of people that have gotten medical care who I don't think would have gotten it without a series of sets of litigation with respect to that. Our prison system was a classic example of an issue that nobody wanted to touch. Mm-hmm. Everybody knew it was broken. Nobody really disputed that. But these were prisoners. Mm-hmm. So who wants to be a champion for them? And similar impact with respect to our juvenile system. Social Security benefits. Shortly after Ronald Reagan was elected, and this was actually a move that began before he was elected, there was a real change in attitude with respect to Social Security, and many clearly disabled people lost benefits, and they were not following their own rules. we filed on behalf of a class of all people who had either been denied or terminated from benefits, and the judge ended up ordering them to offer over 60,000 people new evaluations because the federal judge found that they had not followed their own rules. And much of that was about they didn't pay any attention to treating doctors. Decisions were made almost solely based upon a paper review at the agency without ever setting eyes on the person.
Okay. Now, I'm hearing a lot about the prison case. Did you work on that?
I did. There were really two prison cases. The first case began in state court when a lawyer named Ed Gross, who actually had a radio show then called Rock Lawyer, I can remember getting up in the morning and hearing him on Rock Lawyer. But he had a client who was in the Tennessee State Penitentiary, the main prison. The front part of it's still there. It looks like a medieval castle.
Sure.
As a matter of fact, one of our expert witnesses in another case said that he went on a tour of that prison in the 30s, and it was kind of like an amusement park. You could pay to go on a tour of the prison. It was an incredibly dangerous place where people were double-celled in cells considerably smaller than the room we're in, which is, I don't know, 12 by 12 maybe, or less than that. And he brought a case in Chancery Court, in state court. And we had an excellent set of what are called chancellors. I think Tennessee is one of the few states that still has the old English common law division between the chancellors and the circuit judges. And the bar in Tennessee has always been very protective of those positions because those are the ones that typically review governmental action. So in Davidson County, and I think across the state, we've had a series of extraordinarily good chancellors. And so he brought this case in state court. And Gordon Bonneman and Drake Holliday, Ed Gross asked them to join in this case as counsel for the plaintiffs. And over a period of 3 or 4 years, along with the Prison Rights Project of the American Civil Liberties Unit, union, they brought in expert witnesses to look at every aspect of the prison system. Chancellor Ben Cantrell, who later became a Court of Appeals judge and who just retired several years ago, held that the conditions were so egregious that they violated both the state and federal constitutions. The state appealed that decision to the state court of appeals, and the state submitted all this new evidence saying things are better now. And the state court of appeals vacated the judgment and remanded it, saying, you need to hold a new hearing because they say things are better. So the plaintiff class was kind of back to square one. So some inmates on their own said, this is not going at all well in state court, and they filed pro se litigation without a lawyer in federal court. And the case was assigned to L. Clure Morton, whose brother was the fundraiser for Howard Baker, and Howard Baker nominated him to become a federal judge. He was a conservative, he was a Republican, but he had this odd notion that the law applied to everyone, and he didn't care who got upset by that, whose ox he gored. He was going to apply the law. And he was also very rigorous. All the lawyers were terrified to death of him because if he thought you were saying something that was irrelevant or he didn't want to hear, he'd just go like this, and I'd watch him and skip through my argument until he stopped waving me to go on. But he's always been one of my heroes because of his courage. I remember when I started law school at Vanderbilt. I grew up in the Chicago area. I had never really been in the South. I thought I was going to put in my 3 years at Vanderbilt and immediately go north of the Mason-Dixon line for the rest of my life. And my first day in law school, that was reinforced by two things I read in the paper. The first was Jerry Lee Lewis had been arrested at 3 in the morning firing a revolver outside of Graceland because Elvis wouldn't come and let him in. And the second was there had been a torchlight parade against busing in Nashville, and they had marched on the federal court. And Elkler and Morton was the judge who issued the busing order. And he subsequently, literally, he was ostracized by his peers in the community. I never saw it, but I heard stories about him going to parties and people literally turning their backs on him. He moved to Cookeville, and from then on, lived in Cookeville and commuted from Cookeville until he became a senior judge and actually held hearings. But he was given the responsibility for this prison case, and he appointed attorneys from Bass, Berry, and Sims, one of the biggest and at that time and now most prestigious firms in the city, and Legal Aid to represent the inmates. And again, Gordon Bonneman was the lead attorney with Legal Aid. But for a period of 2 to 3 years, there were a number of us that worked on nothing other than that. There was a paralegal from Bass, Berry, and Sims who did nothing for over a year other than review all the incident reports and all the medical records, because they showed very few incidents of violence. Then when you went through the medical records, on a weekly basis, there'd be 3 or 4 stab reports. There are no incident reports, but these people coming in with stab wounds. And part of the proof was that the state has literally no comprehension of the extent of the violence and the danger in the prison. Their own reporting systems are profoundly dysfunctional with respect to that. I spent about 6 months seeing people on what was called the check-in unit. And the check-in unit was where you were in your cell 23 hours a day because you wanted to be in your cell 23 hours a day. It was typically less serious offenders who physically weren't very big or strong. And they would rather be in their cell 23 hours a day than be placed at the risk and the actual injuries that a lot of them had suffered out in the general population, talking about the danger to those inmates. Some mornings I wouldn't get up till 10 o'clock because I didn't really want to go out there again, because it was so profoundly depressing to talk to these people. And there was considerable concern by all the inmates that there would be some type of retaliation if they were to testify. And it was truly an effort by everyone in the program. At that time, Drake Holiday was a managing attorney in our Clarksville office. And we were doing this. This litigation was in federal court here in Nashville. So he was not that involved in it. But one day I just happened to mention to him that one of our key witnesses had been transferred from the main prison here in Nashville to Fort Pillow, which is in West Tennessee, about as far away from anything else as you can possibly be. And he was going to be released early. After we had taken his deposition had been taken and he had talked about what he had seen, within 2 days Well, Drake just said, no problem. He drove to Fort Pillow, straight through, picked the guy up, persuaded him when he was released, instead of getting on a bus and taking off, to come back to Nashville, prepared his testimony on the way back to Nashville, put him on the stand, put on his proof, and then drove him to the bus station. You know, and this wasn't Drake's case, and he literally gave up 48 hours of his life. I mean, totally. So it was really a very tight-knit and committed group of people. Now, part of it was very few of us were married. None of us had kids. We didn't have a life outside of this. So, you know, you stay up all night, you know, that was okay. That was kind of part of the job. And then Elkler Morton, in the prison case, issued a sweeping decision. Subsequently, because there was overcrowding, the case was then inherited by Judge Higgins, who was another Republican appointee. And we were all, oh, no, you know, we're just... Well, and strangely enough, Judge Higgins was another one of those judges who was a conservative Republican who, again, had the odd idea that the law applied to everyone. And he literally enjoined them from admitting any more prisoners into some of the prisons because they were overcrowded, which created a firestorm. One sheriff literally took people in his jail and handcuffed them to the fence at the prison and left them there. And the federal judge issued an order against that sheriff saying, if you want to stay out of prison, you're going to take your prisoners back. And the sheriff did. And the decision, that was only the beginning of the work. And any of these systemic cases, once you get the decision, it's, well, this is what we have on paper now. How does that compare to what's going on? And Gordon Bonneman in particular spent thousands of hours making sure that we went from a prison system which was found to violate the state and U.S. constitutions in almost every aspect to a prison system that was certified by the American Correctional Association at a time when almost no systems had been certified.
Okay, so I guess that was one of your early big cases.
Yeah.
Took you, you say, 2 or 3 years of just that?
Well, you know, I mean, if you count from when the Grubbs case started, which I think was around 75, and I'm sorry, Grubbs was the second case, and I'm blanking on what the name of the state court case was. State court case started in 75. Decision was issued in Grubbs in the early 80s. A special master was appointed. And there was monitoring till the early 90s. Judge Higgins finally found that they were in compliance and dismissed. So we're talking about a period of 15 plus years, mm-hmm, of litigation and monitoring.
Okay. So what happens at the end of all that? How do you, we just move on to the next one?
Well, I mean, especially in the early years, we had a lot of them going on at the same time, and some of them were, you know, here's the written policy, here's the law, but a lot of them were this very factually intensive, what's really going on in the juvenile system, what's really going on in the services that Medicaid recipients get. But from the time I started as a lawyer in 74 until the LSC restrictions came in 1996, we always had a couple of class actions going. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some attorneys did more than others, but I think everybody was involved to some extent, but everybody was also involved in individual cases as well.
Okay. And in, I didn't catch the date earlier, if I did forget. It was 96 when you went to the Tennessee Justice
Center? I went to the Justice Center in 97. The LSC restrictions were 96. And that's when Gordon Bonneman and Michelle Johnson left legal services to do the work that we couldn't do anymore.
Sure. Okay. Okay. Well, what was? Let's talk a little bit about the LSC and the restrictions and ICE. What was the atmosphere like here once those restrictions came down? And there's always been some sort of restriction on what you can do as far as LSC.
Yeah. You know, when I first started out, the Legal Services Corporation was, well, when I first started out, it was the Nixon administration, and
Rumsfeld and Cheney.
And there was, yeah, and there was a lot of attempt to simply eliminate legal services. It was a product of Lyndon Johnson's War on Poverty and the Office of Economic Opportunity. One of the last things Richard Nixon did before he got on the helicopter to go back to California was to sign a bill for a legal services corporation, the idea being this would depoliticize legal services. There had been, especially among the growers in California and California rural legal services, lots of criticism of legal services for their representation. Then the Legal Services Corporation during the Carter era was perceived as a pretty supportive organization. During the Reagan era, we would have monitoring visits, and some of the monitors would be ex-FBI agents who were not lawyers. I vividly remember they would take their trash out every night because they thought we might go through their trash. And so it was a very uncomfortable process for everybody. Then during the early years of the Clinton administration, there was again more support for legal services. But after the contract with America in 1994, one of the, and again, I think headed by the growers, was we are going to take care of this once and for all. And so they said no more class actions for legal services and no more lobbying for legal services.
Let's see. Now, same with my previous notes here. There was a, now, what about Graham Rudman? We had, that was 81, I think. There was some pretty heavy budget cuts.
Yeah, yeah. The way I remember, our budget was cut by 25%. We had gone through a period where we had achieved the goal of one lawyer for every 5,000 low-income people. And that was then and remains to this day the high watermark as far as the number of lawyers devoted to legal services. We're one of the few programs that didn't lay anybody off, but that's just because as people left, we didn't replace them. Mm-hmm. In 1980, in our Nashville office, I was the managing attorney for the general section, which had 11 lawyers, and we also had a family law section and a consumer section. We now have like 9 lawyers for the whole office. Mm-hmm. And that's actually something of an increase, but we had a far larger staff and a far greater capacity even before the restrictions took place to take on, for example, a class action. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there were devastating cuts. Some of the more junior people thought they might be laid off, so they left. They ended up doing some pretty good stuff, like Bill Purcell, who became the mayor of Nashville, Juliet Griffin, who's a U.S. magistrate, Walter Kurtz, who was a circuit judge. So, I mean, they continued the work in other ways, but we lost some tremendously talented people.
All right. I guess the next thing is the merger in 2001. How did that affect
Well,
Washington?
I wasn't around then. I
Oh,
was
you didn't go
at
there.
the Justice Center, but I think there was a lot of apprehension about that. Part of it for a good reason, which is because the programs were pretty regionalized, the local bar felt a lot of ownership in the program. And when you consolidated our program, that included counties all the way from Oak Ridge in the east to Dixon in the west, a swath of, I don't know, maybe 200 miles or close to it. And I think that part was and remains a problem. On the other hand, at least for Legal Aid Society of Middle Tennessee, I think it went really well in a lot of respects. Part of it had to do with the fact that one of the programs we were merged with was Rural Legal Services, which served kind of eastern Middle Tennessee and East Tennessee up to Knoxville. Neil McBride, their director, and a number of their attorneys were just great, great lawyers. And South Central Legal Services had some great lawyers too, like David Kozlowski. And Ashley Wiltshire was a consummate diplomat, who can be always was very sensitive to everyone's perceptions, but on the other hand, also got things done. So I think it really went well, despite the fact that there was a lot of apprehension about it.
Okay. Well, what do you, as far as your case is concerned, what do you think was, we talked about the prison case, what other cases are high, sort of high water marks?
Well, we find
Do you have a favorite that you like to tell at cocktail
yeah,
parties or?
I mean there are kind of two. One because it just got so totally crazy that the other because of the impact. We had started to represent kids at Spencer Youth Center who were mentally retarded. And some of them were referred to us by the staff at the training school. I think it's okay for me to say that now. They won't get in trouble anymore since it was 30 years ago or more, who were moderately retarded and were in pretty great physical danger, and the programs were just grossly inappropriate. And I mean, I'm talking about kids who the other kids would say, go hide behind that bush, and they'd find that person 6 hours later because they had been told to hide behind the bush and nobody had told them to come out. And those kids with that degree of retardation can be easily goaded, don't have the verbal skills to respond, so they respond physically. So they spend an inordinate amount of time in isolation and stayed longer than everybody else. Well, we had four or five of those kids referred to us, and Andy Shukoff, who was then a law student but subsequently went to work at Legal Services, then became a juvenile judge, kept bugging me every time he saw me because, as a law student, he had gone out there and seen me. When are you going to do something about this? So we finally filed litigation in Chancery Court again, in state court, on behalf of all the mentally retarded kids in the system. Well, to our amazement, after we filed it, we found that first of all, there weren't Let, it was less than 10% of the population that was truly mentally retarded when you applied a rigorous definition. The second thing was the kids we had been seeing with the IQs in the 50s were the exception rather than the rule. Most of the kids were mildly retarded, and they had the same problems as everybody else. It was just a little bit worse. And so the case really morphed into a look at the whole system. both sides hired experts, a set of people from Peabody College formed their own corporation so they could contract with the state to serve as experts for the state. One of our experts was Jerry Miller, who was notorious because he, in a very short period of time, simply closed all the institutions in the state of Massachusetts and said they're all going to be deinstitutionalized. And apparently there was chaos for a while, and there are mixed opinions about how that worked in the short term. I think in the long term, everybody realizes now that institutionalization is kind of a last resort. But we went and interviewed kids. We discovered physical abuse of the kids. We disclosed that to the court. The staff at one of the institutions, Taft Youth Center, walked out en masse. The kids rioted after the staff walked out. The district attorney brought actions against many of the kids. We were concerned about what was going to happen in those criminal proceedings if we proceeded with our case, which we did. A couple of years later, the state fired a number of people at Taft Youth Center because of what was going on. And we finally entered into an agreed order, which then morphed into about 10 years of monitoring and special masters. So that was one case. Oh, and my favorite story about that is, you know, we would call up these experts from all over the country to try and help us. And one of them was a priest who also, I think, was a PhD in something. And Andy Shukoff talked to him, and he was going to do monitoring, and he was going to bring a bunch of nuns with him. And Andy said, "Why are you going to bring the nuns? Do they have some special knowledge about this?" And he said, "Have you ever tried to cross-examine a nun?" He didn't become a special expert for us, but that was kind of the norm at that time. We got anonymous calls telling us not to stick around after dark at some of the places because of what they had heard staff saying. So it was exciting. The other case, there were no riots or anything like that, was a case called Samuels, and I talked about it a little bit before. With the advent of the Reagan administration, tens of thousands of people in Tennessee who had been receiving benefits were cut off. And legal services programs across the state had clients who had been affected by this. So I think every legal services program in the state was involved, and we had about 12 named plaintiffs. We filed it in the Western District of Tennessee. We had about 3 years of discovery, and the judge, Judge McRae in Memphis, issued a sweeping order, which, among other things, said you've got to offer everyone who's been terminated or denied within the last 3 years an opportunity for a new decision. And we, again, spent 10 years of fighting about what kind of notice are the people going to get? How do they have to respond? What's this evaluation going to look like? What reports are we going to get about it? So this is all, anybody who says, well, why don't you just file a class action, has never done a class action. Gordon Bonneman once said, filing a class action, and that's one of the easiest parts, is like giving birth to an elephant. They're incredibly time-intensive and consuming, but you can really change things. And in that case, for a period of 3 or 4 years, every week we would get several notices about people who had been denied or cut off who, when they did a second review, were found to really be eligible. Some of them even sent some of the people found out that it was this Samuels case and sent us money at Legal Services saying thank you for what you had done. So I'm proud of that case, and I'm proud of the fact that it was a collaborative effort across the state with Legal Services lawyers. Frank Block at the Vanderbilt Legal Clinic was very involved in the case.
Okay.
So
great. Now, what should I be asking that I'm not? And know this, like I said, this is something that's going to go on for the next year or so. So if we're done today and you think of something else that you think...
Yeah, well, I'm not sure what questions... One of the most remarkable things for me about Legal Services is this community. The fact that a lot of us have stuck around for, I mean, Dave Tarpley's getting close to 40 years now. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty unusual. Mm-hmm. And even the people that have left to do something else are still very much part of the effort on the board, supporters. When there's incoming fire on us or the Tennessee Justice Center, they're the ones that stand up and say, wait a minute, we got an ethical obligation to be vigorous advocates, and they do just like everybody else, and that's what they're doing, and it's the right thing. So I think just trying to get at that community, and we had a lot of fun too. We did a lot of stuff together. Ashley would have a 4th of July party every year. And Kirk Loggins wrote this wonderful article. You ought to interview Kirk about Legal Service. Do you know who? Kirk Loggins was the state court reporter for the Tennessean from the time I started until 4 or 5 years ago when they bought out a whole bunch of the senior staff. But Kirk was there reporting for all our cases. But he wrote this article comparing going to a bar function in the early 70s and being pretty critical of what he saw, and going to one of Ashley's 4th of July parties and seeing that. And, you know, the thrust of the article was things have changed. There's now not that. But just the camaraderie. You know, and I mean, it continues to exist to this day among us and the folks at the Tennessee Justice Center. I'm not going to say it's a spiritual effort, although a lot of us from very different kinds of, I mean, Ashley went to seminary. I went to Billy Graham's alma mater, but just kind of a shared mission that is really at our core for all of us. And so getting at that, I think, and I'm not about to tell you how you can do that, and how much people help each other and support each other. That continues to this day. Pretty remarkable. I mean, I feel very, very lucky to have a job that I still love most days after 36 years, and a whole lot of it is the people I work with. So,
well, that's an interesting question. You said you came here from Chicago and were expecting to go back. Why did you stay?
Well, one, because I couldn't get a job with Legal Services in Seattle. I would have been gone like that. Every time my wife hears that, she says, but honey, you never would have met me. Oh, you're right. I'm sure glad I didn't do that, and I am glad I didn't do that. Mm-hmm. And I just had some roommates in college, and I thought that was heaven on earth until I visited in the wintertime and saw that it was gray and it rained and it had the highest suicide rate in the country. It was the people here, you know. I mean, I had job offers from other places, but I really wanted to be here. You know, you had Ashley here, Walt Kurtz, Gordon Bonneman, tremendously inspirational people to work with who, so it was just a great supportive group of people. And in the 70s, just this remarkable set of people who kind of ended up here.
All right. Okay, well, like I said, this has been fun.
Oh, good.
And this continues for probably until around January or February. If at some point in the next few weeks you come across something you think you should have said, feel free to get back in touch with me. It doesn't have to be on tape. You can type it up and send it to me. I'm going to use everything I can. I can pull to try to get kind of a larger picture of the organization. So it was a pleasure.
Oh, thank you. I am so glad that you're doing this, and I'm going to love at some point to see if it can be put on tape or CDs, and I can listen to it in the car when I drive or something.
Sure. But the plan at this point is to make them available online.
Great.
I can certainly.